Radio Guerilla.
Emisiune realizată prin amabilitatea Fundației Casa Paleologu.
Bine v-am regăsit în emisiunea Metope. Acum suntem din nou acasă, la Casa Paleologu. Problema tehnică de data trecută s-a rezolvat. Și acum am ca invitat pe un alt filozof, de data asta însă un filozof german, Wolfgang Eilenberger, și o să trec la engleză. Deci emisiunea va fi în engleză. Welcome, I'm very happy that you accepted my invitation. And we are going to speak mainly about your book. This is the occasion on which you are now in Bucharest.
That's cool.
A book published by the same publishing house that published my book, Editura 3. Mm-hmm. And it is a fascinating book about four great philosophers of the 20th century, Heidegger, Cassirer, Wittgenstein and Benjamin. And the book is called Vremea Magicienilor, Die Zeit der Zauberer, The Age of the Magicians. And first of all, why magicians?
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me to the program. It's a pleasure to be here. It's my first time in Bucharest, so
full of new experiences. Well, the title in German is Zeit der Zauberer, and you could, of course, argue that philosophy and magic should have nothing in common, because magic is about creating illusions, to make fakes, to make people believe things that aren't real, and philosophers are working in a different department. They are trying to give arguments, to create clarity and transparency. And this is true, but these four philosophers that I write about had a special gift, and it's the gift of philosophy. Once you read Benjamin or Heidegger or Wittgenstein or Cassirer, the world will look different to you. They will change your perception of everyday life, of your own existence. So once you read Benjamin, the world transforms itself. And that is a magical thing, when you can see the world anew. And I think it's a great virtue and capacity of philosophy to renew our perspective on everyday events and our own lives. And these four philosophers, within 10 years only, reshaped the very idea of what it means to be a human being.
Is there something common between them? They're very different.
They're very different.
Very different personalities, very different perspectives. They didn't like each other,
no,
particularly, to say the least.
Yes. I don't write about groups, because I think human beings in groups tend to become dumber, not smarter. I write about constellations. It's a term by Walter Benjamin. What do I mean by that? Those are four brilliantly gifted young philosophers who come out of the experience of the First World War, traumatized to different extents, and they face a threefold challenge. They are in a biographical crisis, so they do not know who they are. They lost their faith, they lost their love, sometimes they lost their sexual orientation. So they're in a deep personal crisis. The second crisis that they face is the crisis of their own German-speaking culture. It's a political crisis. The two empires, the Hohenzollerns and the Habsburg empires, have collapsed.
Yes, all of them are German-speaking.
All of them are German-speaking. This is something they have in common. And of course, they have in common a certain task or quest. And that is the question of, what does it mean to do philosophy after this horrible war? Everyone who was somehow in his or her right mind realized that we cannot go on like this. We have to rethink the fundamentals of our very culture, especially of the German-speaking culture, because that was a culture that was founded on the very ideals of enlightenment, of the philosophy of Immanuel Kant, shall we say, which was the most important philosopher at that time.
Maybe they also have in common a certain confrontation with Kant.
Yes, they try to work with the Kantian heritage, but feel the need to renew it. And this is actually what they do. They renew philosophy, each in their own way. When we think of these four iconic figures of the 1920s, they can be framed as the founding fathers of the philosophical schools that reign today in contemporary philosophy. For example, Wittgenstein can be seen as one, if not the founding father, of what we call now analytic philosophy. Mm-hmm. Walter Benjamin is the founding father of critical theory of the Frankfurt School. He is the first one to establish that mode of thinking. Martin Heidegger is, I think, the founding father, at least of existentialism as we know it, and also the hermeneutical approach to philosophy. And Ernst Cassirer is one of the main figures of what we now call Kulturphilosophie, cultural philosophy, and semiotics. So within 10 years in this German-speaking world, after the war, the entire idea of what it means to do philosophy will change. And I was interested in the dynamics of these 10 golden years, which were, I believe, the most creative 10 years in the history of philosophy, at least of the 20th century.
And especially in the German-speaking area. There are other figures in the German-speaking area. I think, for example, of Carl Schmitt.
Of course.
Jünger is not a philosopher, but Der Arbeiter, the worker, is a major work also.
Yes. Which only gives more credibility to the idea that those were special years. It would have been very easy to write also a book about Ernst Jünger, Carl Schmitt, Edmund Husserl, and say for example, the young Hannah Arendt or Ludwig Klages.
But you wrote about Hannah Arendt.
Also, that's a later book.
Yes, I have to say to those who listen to us that Wolfram Eilenberger wrote also a book on four great women, four great philosophers and thinkers, on Hannah Arendt, Simone de Beauvoir, Simone Weil, and Ayn Rand.
That's true. It's the second part of this trilogy, and the last part of the trilogy was just published in Germany. It's about the post-war philosophy, and those are again four figures. It's Foucault, cool. Adorno, Susan Sontag, and Paul Feyerabend. Ah. Again, a very interesting constellation. But let's stay with the 1920s.
Yes, absolutely. With the four philosophers, with the magicians.
With the magicians. But not only in philosophy were those magical years, also, for example, in architecture, if we think of the Bauhaus, also in literature, if we think of Thomas Mann and Alexander Döblin and all of these new ideas in literature, especially concerning the novel, in terms of fashion, it's true. In terms of physics, it's true. For example, cinema. So those were years where our, I would argue, entire idea of modernity was reshaped for the very last time. And of course, it was also the last decade when philosophy spoke German. After the 1920s, the center and the focus and the creative core of philosophy moves away from the German-speaking world. It moves to Paris, to France, later on to the US and England. But within those 10 years, I think the German-speaking world was for the last time the center of philosophical innovation.
Mm-hmm. But speaking of the Weimar Republic in general, what explains this unbelievable creativity of these years? Because as you said, in all fields, this period is extremely creative, extremely dynamic.
Yes. I think there is an aspect of contingency, which means we cannot totally explain that miracle. It would be foolish to say I have the theory that explains it. But it is certainly true that a time of crisis is a good time for philosophy. And the year 1919 and the following 10 years were times of an enormous political, economic, cultural, and philosophical crisis.
And a disaster for Germany
of
in many
course,
ways.
When these four young men return from the war, they find a society with no political order. They find an economic disastrous situation, which impoverishes also their families. They have to find new ways of living and making money. And it's also a spiritual crisis, because many of the ideals that were held to be normative before the war, were destroyed. You could not believe, for example, in some kind of heroic ideal of manlihood, because the war had destroyed that. You could not believe in some promise of enlightenment in the terms of eternal peace that Kant had established. Some new mass media were developing during that time, like the movies, like the radio, transforming the very velocity and the idea of what it means to be informed and to inform yourself. And on a cultural level, of course, in physics, the very basis of our world perception, meaning time and space, were revolutionized by Albert Einstein and later on by quantum physics. So there was a great insecurity. I think the foundations of what it means to be a human being were shaken. And this is a time for philosophy where new approaches find a good way to be perceived and to be invented. And I think this is what Wittgenstein, Heidegger, Cassirer, and Benjamin do. They renew the very idea of what it means to do philosophy.
I want to say for those who listen to us that the book is very accessible. Even if you haven't read Wittgenstein or Heidegger or much of them or Cassirer or yes. Benjamin, I wouldn't say an easy read. It's not an easy read, but it's very accessible also for those who are not specializing in philosophy, because you combine in a very pleasant way the biographical aspects with the philosophical aspects.
Yes.
Does a biography count for understanding philosophy?
You see, there is a Platonic idea of what it means to do philosophy. There are eternal questions, there are eternal arguments, and then some people happen to be alive and tackle these questions, but their own biography doesn't matter to the solution of the riddle.
I have to tell you, one of my favorite books is The Lives and the Doctrines of the Philosophers by Diogenes Laertius.
Yes.
And one of the great friends of my father, the philosopher Constantin Noica,
yes.
despised all these biographical anecdotes. Yes. While you make use of the biographical anecdotes, you give them a meaning.
It's true, because it has to do with the idea of what philosophy is for me. And for me, philosophy is a transformative art. It transforms yourself. If it doesn't touch you as a human being, you're not doing it the right way. I know, and I can also acknowledge the view that philosophy is only about arguments and concepts, that it's kind of an analytical Sudoku with concepts. Mm-hmm. They are riddles, complicated riddles with concepts that you have to solve. And your own personal experience or the time that you do that is not important. And one could say that this is the normative view now of philosophy as a scientific endeavor. But these four philosophers had a different idea of what it means to be part of that tradition and to be part of that art. For them, it is a way of finding their own voice, finding the foundations of their culture, and renewing the very idea of philosophy, which for them is not a science. It's very important that Benjamin and Wittgenstein and Heidegger reject a very prevalent and dominant perception of philosophy, which is that philosophy is a science like any other, like biology or physics, and that is able to create some kind of law, some kind of expectation, some kind of final theory. But they would not do this.
Yeah,
they would reject the idea. And this is important to me. I would like to revitalize the idea that philosophy is an existential craft, an existential art, and these four human beings, exceptional human beings, embody that very
All
idea.
All of them?
Well, Cassira a bit less so, but I think I'm able to show that Cassira was also thinking for his own life when he did this. He was a more decent, a more moderate, a more shy character. He's maybe the only one who did not attempt suicide. He's the only one who would really work. He's the only one who didn't have real troubles with his sexual life, for example. So he is the sane one in this quartet. But still, he was very perceptive to what happened in his own culture. And maybe this is not also important to this book. As you say, it's a narrative book. It's meant to read as a novel. Three of them were also German Jewish philosophers. And this Jewish experience of being an outsider and not being part of the center of the culture was very important to them.
And the other one was the opposite of Jewish.
Of course, he was. Yes, Heidegger.
We will take a pause for publicity and we return in a few moments.
Metope, emisiune realizată prin amabilitatea Fundației Casa Paleologu.
Metope, îl am ca invitat pe Wolfram Eilenberger. Now I will switch again to English. Wolfram Eilenberger wrote a fascinating book, Vremea Magicienilor, the Age of the Magicians, Zeit der Zauberer. And I would like to continue this idea of the importance of the biographical. And let's take shortly all of the four, starting with whom? With the oldest one or the most spectacular among them?
They're all spectacular.
Cassira is not that spectacular.
Okay.
am I wrong?
No, I think he's spectacular in the breadth and the depths of his knowledge. He's probably,
yes,
after Leibniz, the only philosopher who published about everything and in a profound and meaningful way.
But why?
Because his philosophy is a philosophy of plurality, of mm-hmm. the symbolic forms. It tries to capture the entirety of a human culture. And his very idea is, and I think it's a very exciting one and still valid one, is that what makes us human is our use of symbols, especially language, but not only language, also
symbolic forms.
Symbolic forms, as he calls it. And his main work, The Philosophy of Symbolic Forms, was finished within these 10 years from 1919.
It's a huge
to 1920.
Work.
It's a huge work. Yep. And I think it is still a work that has philosophical relevance to our present day, because we try to find a common language for the plurality that we live in.
It is a philosophy of culture. It's
it
a kind
true.
Of encyclopedic endeavor in a way, you know?
Yes, and it gives an answer to the Kantian question, what is man? And the answer that Cassira gives is man is an animal symbolicum, a symbolic using animal. And for Cassira, in a neo-Kantian tradition, he tries to spell out the different ways that human beings use symbols. This can be a scientific way, this can be an artistic way, it can be a religious way, and it can also be a philosophical way. And his idea of philosophy is to give a synthesis of the entire cultural process. And here we can see something that's important to the Weimar Republic thinking, because those were times marked by plurality of centrifugal forces, marked by the attempt to make sense of this new culture that was perceived to be a chaos. And Cassira did that by trying to give a foundation which was based on semiotics.
And he had, until 1933, a very good career as a professor, unlike some of the others.
It's true.
Because Benjamin never succeeded in having a academic career, and Wittgenstein despised any academic career. While Cassira became a full professor after the war, we have to explain that in Germany there is this very cruel system of Privatdozent and Ordinarius.
Yes.
So you are a full professor, Ordinarius, or a Privatdozent when you teach without getting paid.
Yes. Yes.
So Cassira became quite early in the 20s.
Already by 1914 he was a Privatdozent.
He was an Ordinarius after the war.
Yes. After the war, yeah.
And he became also, he was in Hamburg.
Yes.
He had a leading position.
He was a rector of the university.
We have actually two rectors, Heidegger and Cassira, both rectors of an university.
Yes.
But what a contrast between them.
Absolutely, because Cassira was steaming from a German Jewish family, a well-to-do German family, which were his parents were industrialists. His brother was a publisher. So it was part of the cultural elite in Germany. And he was also a philosopher in the tradition of Kant. And by that time, the neo-Kantian school was the dominant school of academic philosophy in Germany. And Cassira in the 1920s was the leading figure of what was then called neo-Kantian philosophy. But
the Marburg school.
The Marburg school. And then there was also other schools in Baden, for example. But what is interesting about Cassira and interesting about all of these four figures, they do not fit into one school thinking. They are far too creative, far too inventive, far too deviant in their own thinking to be following the path that is already given to them. And for Cassira, for example, the break with the neo-Kantian philosophy was that he would not only focus on science as a symbolic system to approach reality, but also to myth, also to language, also to the arts. He had a much broader vision of what it means to approach reality in a meaningful sense. And I think that vision, that broad vision, is still very attractive to us.
Yeah, so in a way, he was an academic philosopher because he had a position as an academic, as a professor, but he's not the typical academic philosopher who specializes in one thing.
No, he's a free mind and he's a free thinker. And I think freedom is the essence of his philosophy. And when you talk about the academic existence, it is true that he's the only institutional animal of these four, because the other three are fiercely, you could say, anti-academic philosophers.
Even Heidegger.
Heidegger claimed, actually invented the term of akademische Philosophie as a derogatory term.
But this is also a theme in Schopenhauer. Schopenhauer also wrote a brilliant and very funny essay against the Universitätsphilosophie.
Absolutely. But if you think of the history of philosophy from Spinoza on, say, those are not academic philosophers. Usually the most interesting minds, the most creative ones, they work outside of academy.
Yes, David, but what about Kant?
No. But you know, this comes very late. David Hume, for example, was not an academic philosopher, nor was Descartes in that sense. So the idea that the only way to do philosophy is at a German university, that's a 19th century idea. And the great minds of philosophy that I'm interested in, not only in this book, but for example, in the other book too, the four female philosophers, none of them held an academic position, really. And for me, it is also important to convey in my books the idea that to be a philosopher and to write good philosophy, the academy might not be the best place for you. And for example,
that's good news.
In Benjamin or in Heidegger and also in Wittgenstein, they are living proof of that fact.
So I haven't done a mistake by leaving academia at some point.
But let's be honest, the state of academic philosophy right now is pitiful. Worldwide, it is an industry and a career. It is an industry of papers that no one reads and a career that is driven not by knowledge, but by careerism. You have to specialize very early. You have to only publish in that language, in that special field to become a professor. And if there's one mission that I have as a writer of about philosophical topics is to give a sense of the energy, the power, the transformative beauty of the philosophical craft, and those fear embody that very idea.
Yeah, and it's why your book has such a success.
I don't know if that's the only reason. I think also the reason is that those four, or at least three of them, are iconic figures. You know, Benjamin and Wittgenstein and Heidegger, they are more than philosophers. They embody a certain sense of what it means to be a thinker. Mm-hmm. And there are still people, I think, in Bucharest right now who have a poster of Walter Benjamin in their room, or even of Ludwig Wittgenstein. They became icons. And it's also significant to me that within these 1920s, it was a time where philosophers became cultural icons. Mm-hmm. And that hasn't happened. It has happened in France in the 1960s, maybe for the last time, like Foucault or Derrida. But after that, we lack these symbolic figures.
Okay, let's move to the icons now.
Okay.
Benjamin or Heidegger?
Maybe we start with Heidegger, the dark one, the dark lord of philosophy, as I call him. And he is a very different cat than Cassira. He doesn't come from a wealthy family, but from a peasant family. He's not from the north, but from the south, from Freiburg.
From a Catholic south.
He was raised by theologians. He was to become a priest, actually, initially.
And there is an Augustinian touch in his writings.
A radicality, you could say.
Where he could say like the Pope, Ich bin ein Augustiner.
He could say that. And for Heidegger, early on, the idea that he had was that something is fundamentally wrong with his culture and with philosophy. And of course, he creates by the 1920s then this grand narrative of the pre-Socratic mistake, that something went really wrong 2,500 years ago in our culture with the question of being, roughly speaking. And he would like to give a therapy to philosophy and his entire culture. If we follow that path, we are doomed. It's a path into darkness. And he strongly believes and maybe overestimates the power of philosophy, because his idea really is that he could recreate and remake the entire Western culture by giving a different sense of what philosophy is. And then in the 1930s, we can see the continuation of that foolish idea of being able to remake an entire culture by making it political. Because then in the 1930s, and this is also very different from Cassira, who had to leave Germany never to return to that country by the 1930s, he joins the NSDAP and becomes the rector of the Freiburg University. And he believes for some years, maybe 2.5 years of his life, that he can become the Meisterdenker, the master thinker of the new Nazi movement. And this is, of course, one of the great tragedies of German philosophy, that possibly the most gifted philosopher of his generation became a Nazi.
But he's not the only one who had this kind of illusion. I'm thinking of Carl Schmitt, for example.
Yes.
Bäumler also.
Yes.
Bäumler is a very gifted philosopher. He's very interesting in what he wrote about Kant.
Yes.
So these brilliant minds had this illusion that they could somehow give a philosophical direction to the movement, the Bewegung.
Yes, and this is always a danger in philosophy, that you think that when you have some insight into philosophical topics, you can also apply them to politics. right away. I think this is one of the great dangers of philosophy. I understand you wrote a book about the pathologies of power.
And I wrote also about Schmitt. So yes. That's why I know so well this kind of illusion.
Yes.
In the case of Schmitt, it was particularly ridiculous because he couldn't fool anyone. It was obvious that it was opportunist.
Yes.
While in the case of Heidegger, I would like to discuss the duration of this illusion. Well, when did he wake up, so to say?
Well, he woke up quite early, I would say, by 1935, 1936.
Why?
He realized that the alternative that the movement of Hitler was supposed to be was not an alternative in his own sense, that it was rather a continuation of the very dark ideas of technicality, totalitarianism, also politics founded on ideas of nation, for example. And he for a very short time thought that the Nazi movement, which didn't have a philosophy, but was a movement, would be an alternative to two alternatives he despised. And they are very interesting, even to our present times, because the German-speaking culture in the 1920s was somehow caught in between the alternatives of the Soviet experiment that turned towards Stalinism during the 1920s and what was then called civilization. And that meant the mercantile libertarian approach of the US. And the prevalent feeling in the German-speaking culture was we don't want to become a civilization in the American sense, and we don't want to follow the Soviet example. We have to find a third way for our culture. And
Kultur as opposed to civilization.
For example, Kultur, although that would not be Heidegger's way. But the entire idea is we have to find that third way. And if we think of the political situation in Europe right now, we can see a similar constellation. We have with Putin a system of a totalitarian kind that has some allure, even maybe to Romania. And we have with Trump and basically a more radicalized way of a libertarian mercantile approach. And once again, I think Europe is in need of defining itself on its own terms. And what is interesting that the 1920s had the same challenge. And what is scary is that Germany found a third way, a very dark way, a way into disaster by the 1930s, based on Heideggerian ideas and Heideggerian longings. And I think if there's one teaching from the 1920s is we are somewhat in the same situation, but I hope we don't have to commit the same mistakes again.
We move on to the two others.
Yes.
Benjamin.
Benjamin.
Maybe the most colorful.
Yes, the most enigmatic in a way. He was, as a person, of course, a very dark character, a depressive mind, what we would now call a loser. He would drift.
Yes, an absolute loser, yes.
An absolute loser. He would drift around Berlin. He had no money, had no idea, wanted to do something with media, but didn't know what.
All his projects were failures.
Yes. And he was also, of course, in a difficult situation because he did not go to war. And he had fooled the institutions.
This is a very strong contrast to Wittgenstein,
yes, yes.
Who took pride in having been a good soldier.
Yes. And Benjamin went to Switzerland to avoid being drafted. And once you wanted to become an academic, there were two things that you'd rather not be in the 1920s. First one would be Jewish, and the second one, you had avoided the war. And Benjamin was both of them. He tried to gain access to the academic sphere, but they rejected him time and again. And then he became a figure that is a very common figure in the 1920s, the freelance journalist and cultural commentator. Because you would have to imagine that by the 1920s, there were more than 120 newspapers published in Berlin alone on a daily basis. So the entire idea of what a feuilleton is, cultural criticism and kind of a higher journalism, was recreated then. And Benjamin became the great iconic figure of that period, I sometimes call him.
Already at that time?
Yes, he was. There's a myth about Benjamin that he was not well acknowledged during the 1920s. It is not true. By the end of the 1920s, he was probably the most important literary critic in Germany and perceived as such by some. So he had a career of a kind, but it was not exactly the career that he wanted.
He tried to become a professor, and he always failed.
Yes, but you.
But his thesis for the habilitation. Once again, we have to explain.
Yes.
In Germany, there are these two
books
theses: the doctoral thesis, and then the Habilitationsschrift.
Yes.
Which is not exactly the habilitation in Romanian in Romania now.
Yes.
Other countries adopted the habilitation, but actually it's not the same thing.
Yes.
And so his Habilitationsschrift, his thesis for habilitation, is a brilliant work.
It was all too brilliant. It was
too
rejected
brilliant.
Because people, and for a good reason, said, we don't know what it's about. We can't even read it. It's too difficult. And it's true that Benjamin had a very peculiar use of the German language, as did Heidegger, for example. Mm-hmm. And this is also something about these four magicians that they have in common. They use the language in a very special way. They have their own style. You read Benjamin, and after a page, you know it's Benjamin because it's that sound, mm-hmm. it's that style.
Even Cassira?
Cassira is the most academic of them. But for Wittgenstein, it's also true, and for Heidegger.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So they are also poets of a kind. Mm-hmm. And I think that poetic vision of philosophy, to see in every small detail of the modern world the entirety of an culture. This is the great magic of Benjamin. If you look at, for example, commercials, or these shoes, or the shape of this glass, with a worldview that is akin to Benjamin, you can see how the entire forces of a culture are condensed in that very object. And he made us see, he gave, I think, us a new way to see contemporary culture, and this vision is still with us. So he actually created a new way to see the world.
Tell us a few words about the Habilitationsschrift.
Yes.
I think it's an important moment.
It's an important moment. It's called Der Ursprung des deutschen Trauerspiels.
Yes, it's about the origins of the German tragedy.
Of the German tragedy. And with everything that Benjamin writes, it's meant to be a historical work on the origins of the Baroque theater in Germany. This is one. But it's also a book on the origins of the German tragedy as a political tragedy that was unfolding during the Weimar Republic. And that book also deals with the idea of death. And the celebration of death in a certain way in the Baroque theater. This is one part. And I would also say that it's an analysis of the German character and the German political situation of the Weimar Republic. What Benjamin wrote during the 1920s was another book, equally celebrated, Die Wahlverwandtschaften of Goethe, a critique of that book. By that time, Benjamin had detected that by working with German classical literature and giving interpretations to it, you could also give an interpretation to the actual political situation in Germany. And this is what he did in a very, very deep sense. He would write about literature, but he would never write about the work as such. He would write about the present political mm-hmm. situation, thereby establishing a new kind of literary criticism.
Yeah, I would say that he never writes only about the subject of the writing.
Of course, yes.
He always writes about this and something else.
Yeah, it's a Benjamin doublespeak, if you want.
Yeah, and correspondence.
Exactly.
Because Baudelaire is probably the holy patron of
absolutely.
Benjamin.
And he also writes a book about the task of the translator, which is about Baudelaire and his translations. But again, it's not about Baudelaire. It's about Benjamin's view of the world. And he is probably the mind of the 20th century, I think, that shapes a philosophy out of literary sources only. He has that gift to read literature as a way of philosophy and then create his own philosophy in dialogue with these works of the 19th and 17th century.
Since I mentioned Baudelaire,
yes.
Benjamin is a flâneur.
Yes. A flâneur.
In what sense? How is he a flâneur in the Berlin of the 20s?
Well, you know, 20. He starts his work on his Berlin childhood with the sentence that it's easy to find your way in a big city, but it's difficult to get lost in the right way. And the flâneur is a model of existence. Which means you're not walking with an aim, but you're open to the experiences that are given to you. And you let enrich yourself by every detail of this new experience of the grand city, of the contingency, of everything that Baudelaire talks about. And Benjamin praises that experiences. He praises contingency. He praises openness. He praises also chaos. And when we think, for example, of Heidegger as a possible opposite, at the same time, he hates the city. He hates contingency. He hates modern life. And in this book, what I try to present is that there are four German-speaking characters of the somewhat same generation that respond to the impulses of their own culture in radically different ways. Wittgenstein's reaction to the modern life is different from that of Benjamin and that of Heidegger.
In what sense?
In the sense that Benjamin praises the life and Wittgenstein rejects. He goes to the countryside to become a teacher, to leave modern life as such, which he thinks is debased and without spirit. And
this is a Tolstoy influence.
That's a Tolstoy influence. Of course, he hated country life too. He had a very hard time with himself and he was very much disappointed by the peasant life too. But this contrast between rural experiences and metropolitan experiences emerges within the 1920s. And again, for example, think of the Romanian situation right now. The divide between the rural life and the metropolitan life is also a political divide. Right now, it divides the political cultures throughout Europe. In France, you have that divide. In Germany, you have it. You have it also in Romania. So the way you respond to the big city experience as an experience of modernity has also always a political implication. And you can see it clearly when you contrast Benjamin and Heidegger. Heidegger would hate Berlin, would never go to Berlin, would reject the idea of teaching in Berlin, whereas Benjamin would find his own philosophy within this experience of the roaring 20s in Berlin.
It's strange that Carl Schmitt was also from the Catholic part of Germany.
Yes.
And he lived in Berlin for many years.
Yes.
Although he was not ein Berliner at all.
But he was very depressed there. He thought he lost himself. He was
a little bit like Benjamin in Berlin.
Yes, yes. It was
speaking also about his personal life,
prostitutes.
Yes.
And, you know, this is part of it. But you see, Carl Schmitt is an interesting example because he is living within that tension and his own experience is somewhat
In between,
which only means that these four characters maybe draw a tableau where you can fit in other characters too.
Mm-hmm. More about Benjamin.
Well,
he belongs to a group.
He belongs to a group that later on emerges as the Frankfurt School. And it's a group of philosophers, cultural critics. For example, the young Adorno becomes a pupil of Benjamin. Then there is Ernst Bloch, who tries to copy Benjamin a lot. And this group of four or five or six young intellectuals, which are based in Frankfurt and then move to Berlin, this is the core of what we later perceive as the Frankfurt School of Philosophy.
But what is the place of Benjamin within the Frankfurt School?
Well, I think he is the Ursprungsgestalt, figure of origin. And it's very hard to find anything interesting in Adorno that you would not already see in Benjamin. Mm-hmm. So I think really when we have to approach the Frankfurt School as a tradition, Benjamin is the founding figure. And actually Bloch and Adorno thought so too. And they say it many times that without also the aura of Benjamin, they would not have been able to find their
I'm
own way.
I'm asking this because he's not really a maître d'école.
Yes.
He's not a maître à penser in the sense of being a master of a school of thought.
Yes.
Like, I don't know, Charles Maurras and the Action Française.
Yes.
He's not like this.
No.
He's an inspiring figure, but without positioning himself as a head of the school.
Yes. Actually, that's also true of Wittgenstein. It's probably also true of Heidegger, who didn't want to create a school. But Benjamin, of course, is also rejecting a certain idea of systematic philosophy. And he thinks there is something dangerous about systems, politically dangerous about systems. Once you create a system, you create a space where everything fits in beforehand. You know where to put things, and you know where to put individuals. And I think his entire idea of rejecting any systematicity in philosophy is actually a political idea. It's an idea of freedom, of openness, of not being defined by a conceptual framework that already exists. And this is something that you can see in Adorno later on, where Adorno, with his own negative dialectics, rejects any idea of defining individuals and concepts that already exist. And this is something that Benjamin, by his minute, precise descriptions of everyday life, already creates for us.
We take a short pause because we still have one major philosopher to discuss, Wittgenstein. In a few minutes after the pause. Am revenit în direct în emisiunea Metope. Îl am ca invitat pe Wolfram Eilenberger, care a scris o carte fascinantă, Vremea magicienilor. Acum trec din nou la engleză. I switch again to English. And we realized that we have only a few minutes left for Wittgenstein.
It's so a philosophical dialogue. What should
we
expect?
We are very grateful to Radio Guerrilla that they gave us a few more minutes, but it is very ironic to speak in a few minutes about Wittgenstein. I would like to use a biographical detail. Among these four philosophers, he is the only one to have been a great fighter in the war.
Yes.
Praising himself for his courage and his fighting skills. And at the same time, he became a kind of Tolstoyan, a disciple of Tolstoy, the apostle of nonviolence.
Yes.
It's a very interesting contradiction.
Yeah, he's a modern saint, we could say, in his own right. And the idea that you have to seek experiences that are close to death, which Jaspers called Grenzerfahrung, that we find our true self by exposing us to very great dangers, for example, like in war, was a very popular idea in the 1910s and the 1920s. Heidegger makes the same claim. In the near of death, we find ourselves. And Wittgenstein did kind of believe or buy into that idea that we have to expose ourselves to the greatest danger to find our true voice. And actually, through a traumatic experience, I think he was transformed during the war from this very heroic, manly figure to a much softer and almost mystical thinker. And the war experience was for him a transformative one, as was the philosophical experience during that war, because he wrote that book, which became the Tractatus, between and during the war.
Okay, and there is a detail in the book that comes to my mind right now. After the war, he gave up all his property.
Yes.
I mean, he gave up to his brothers, and to his sisters and his brother. Why? Why did he return from war with this firm project?
When I started to explain to you the situation that these four magicians found themselves in after the war, that there was a personal crisis, a cultural crisis, and a philosophical crisis.
So which is the personal crisis?
The personal crisis is that he does not believe that you can live a decent life as a rich man. His idea is that you have to abstain from any kind of luxury, of any kind of false security, any kind of heritage,
is
something
this
that you have.
Christian conviction.
I think it's a religious conviction that he takes probably from Tolstoy and some other figures,
or from Jesus himself.
Yes,
Saint Franciscus.
It's hard to answer the question if Wittgenstein was Christian, but he certainly had a spiritual experience that changed his life during the war and also changed his philosophy, because Wittgenstein's aim in the Tractatus is actually something very simple. He tries to draw a line between what can be meaningfully said in the human language and what cannot be said. Actually, it's the Kantian line, because the Kantian project is the same project. What can we say meaningfully, and what can we say pretending to be meaningful, but actually being nonsensical. And Wittgenstein thinks he can draw that line. He can make that distinction by a new symbolic method, which he calls logic, which we now learn in logic courses. And there's this new language around that enables him to draw that line. And the upshot or the morale of his philosophy is that everything that philosophers used to talk about as their own field is meaningless. In other words, there is no such thing as a philosophical discourse. There is scientific discourse, and then there is meaningless discourse. And the radicality of his philosophy, matched by the radicality of Heidegger's philosophy, is that the last 2,500 years of philosophy is meaningless squabble. We have to abstain from the very idea that there exists such a thing as philosophy, which does not mean for Wittgenstein, and this is important, that the philosophical questions are meaningless. It just means that they cannot be answered in the language that we have. And this is, so to speak, the mystical turn that he takes during the war years. And this has to do with his religious conviction that the meaning of life cannot be articulated, but it has to show itself in your everyday existence.
At the beginning of our discussion, I asked about the common points between the four.
Yes.
Maybe is a certain kind of marginality common to all four,
certainly,
even in the case of Cassirer?
Yes, but we know this from Socrates on, that you have to be a marginal figure to be a good philosopher, that once you're in the center of a culture, you are blind to the very essence of that culture. And I'm interested in outsiders, and the books that I write are about outsiders. And the fact that three of them were Jewish Germans actually already puts them into a marginal situation concerning their very own culture.
From the point of view of the others, but what about themselves? How did they leave their Jewishness?
Well, Wittgenstein was rejecting the very idea that he was a Jew. Benjamin was introduced to his own Jewish heritage by Scholem, another very important figure of the 1920s. And Cassirer was a non-religious Jew, which means that he was not a believer in the Jewish religion, but he identified himself with the Jewish cultural tradition of the German kind, from Moses Mendelssohn and Lessing on. So they had different approaches to their own Jewishness. But of course, during the 1920s, they became aware that they cannot do away with their Jewishness because other people will define them as Jews, and then they had to face them.
But they were perfectly assimilated Jews.
I don't think there is something like a perfectly assimilated Jew in Germany. And although the 1920s were relatively relaxed for them, there's still something that they're all aware of.
I'm saying this because Hitler always repeated that the assimilated Jew is more dangerous than the traditional Jew.
Yes, because he, of course, had the idea that when a Jew is assimilated, he is still a Jew and will play a false game with his own culture. And this suspicion was put on Cassirer, for example, because Cassirer, as a leading Kantian, was reproached of a Jewish Kant, that he would teach Kant in a Jewish way, which was a very ugly, an ugly thing to say about him. But to imagine that there was a non-problematic way of being Jewish in Germany in the 1920s, that's wrong. And these three figures show that very clearly. And this book is also,
and in a way, also the fourth.
Another way, also the force, you know, by negativity.
Yes.
And the book is, you know, I think there are many ways to read this book, but it's also a book about the loss of the German Jewish heritage that Germany and the German culture suffered after the 1930s. Mm-hmm. And I think my culture, I mean, there are many things that were extremely traumatic after the 1930s. But as a culture, I think the German culture never recovered from that loss.
The same is true about the Romanian culture in the 20th century. So thank you so much for this very interesting discussion. There are many other questions that I had, but please read the book. It's a wonderful experience. As I said, it's very accessible. It's about philosophy, but it's readable by someone who is not a specialist in one of these four authors. Și vă dau întâlnire tot așa săptămâna viitoare, marți la Metope.
Thank you.
Metope, emisiune realizată prin amabilitatea Fundației Casa Paleologu.